Welcome to Bringing Forth, a podcast on spirituality and parenting, where we share stories, insights, and wisdom at the intersection of parenting, spirituality, and real life. This is your host, Rachel Dahl O'Mahony. Hello, listeners, and welcome. I want to thank today my newest patron, Mary, as well as Donna and Patty, for your support for this podcast. You're making this possible for me, and without them, and those of you listening who support this podcast, this would be a financial liability to me and my family. So thank you. Please be in touch, listeners. I would love to hear what you're loving and, well, maybe hating about this podcast. Follow me on Instagram and on Facebook at Bringing Forth Podcast. When I first became a parent, I, like so many before me, didn't have a clue. I had a traumatic first 6 weeks where some pretty bad stuff happened, and maybe I'll talk about that some other time on this podcast. But anyway, there were voices all around me that were literally telling me I could not and should not be caring for my new child. Slowly, though, as I made sense of being a parent, made sense of my new body, made sense of this new being who had emerged from my body, I started to feel more awe that even though people were telling me otherwise, she was entrusted to me, that I was entrusted to her. I had a whole new sense of stewardship. A theology emerged, and it still resounds in me, or a spirituality perhaps, an idea that God trusts us with each other. God trusts us with our children. Beyond that, with our neighbors, with our soil, with our homeless brothers and sisters, with our insects and our enemies, our habitats and our waterways. And, well, God trusts us, all of us, with each other. That God, for some unfathomable reason, sees goodness in us. This spirituality has motivated the best in me. And on some days as a person, it has motivated me to step into my best self. It has motivated me as a person who votes, as a caretaker of a tiny plot of land. This entrusting has been really important for me. Our guest today, Chad, shares something similar about how original blessing matters to him and his family. This is the idea that we are fundamentally good and that goodness is all around. The idea centers goodness over sin without denying that people also do lousy stuff. If you're interested in it, you should Google it or get a couple of books from the library on it. And you should listen to this podcast. It's rich and it's a rich and wise theology and spirituality. I hope you'll listen this week with a sense and question of how you are deeply trusted to care for the people who are around you. How are you doing this well? And how can we do this better? Our guest today is Chad Abbott. Chad is a conference minister in the UCC, United Church of Christ, in Indiana and Kentucky. Chad's the author of a couple of books, his latest of which is Sacred Habits, The Rise of the Creative Clergy. He's passionate about local churches, pastors, and spirituality. He's a trained labyrinth facilitator, a spiritual director, and a storyteller. Chad and his wife, Shannon, live in Indianapolis. Chad is not only a pastor, husband, and father. Chad is a runner, a musician, a first-degree black belt in karate, a Converse shoe collector, a lover of laughter and nature, and an all-around spiritual pilgrim. Chad is white, middle-class, straight, progressive, and cisgender. Welcome, Chad. I'm so glad to have this conversation with you today. So just to get started, thank you for doing this.
Of course.
I'm really grateful. So let's just start with, tell me who you are parenting, how your children came to you. So like if they're biological or adopted, things like that, and who you're parenting with.
Okay. So I am parenting with Shannon Abbott, who we met in college and we're married at the end of college, and so we've been together about 23 years total, but been married for 20. And our daughter, Isabel, Issa for short, She is now going to be 14 next week. Crazy. And our son, Solomon, is 9. So both of them are birth children.
Tell me a little bit about your children's way of being in the world. Mm.
They are both incredibly creative kids. I mean, they're just very thoughtful. So they, in terms of their creativity, our daughter, for example, is a dancer. Our son's more kind of a musician and really a really deep thinker. They're both very kind of thoughtful in terms of the way they approach life and the way they approach other people. So they're, our son in particular is kind of our empath, you know, he's just very empathetic and very caring and compassionate. We're a family that loves nature and loves animals in particular. So we're very, yeah, I think we think about ourselves in connection to the wider whole. And so our kids, I think, have picked up on some of that. They're very compassionate with animals, and they're both very funny. they like to play practical jokes. They love April Fool's Day. They're very just fun people to be around, and they really make me laugh. I mean it's funny some of the things they will say, some of the things they will do, and some of the ideas they come up with, and so it's they're just a lot of fun to be around. Most of the time.
Yeah, sure, right.
Let me qualify that.
In real life.
In real life, most of the time, it's fun to be around.
How does this love for animals actually, like, in what ways does that become concrete choices, or how does that manifest?
So it manifests in care of creation, so the way in which we care for all of creation, and especially animals. We've adopted a dog, but my son's favorite animal is birds. And so we like bird watching, we like putting food out for birds. We just, that kind of stuff. And other practical places, it also plays itself out in our diet. So we don't eat things that come from animals. And so there's that aspect of things as well. So we've been vegan for probably 15 years now. I think it'll be 16 years in July.
Mm-hmm.
So we've kind of taken that on as a family lifestyle. There's always, with our kids, there's always this, like, pushback a little bit. They can get their mind around not eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder when you talk about cheese and dairy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The ways in which our food system is set up is very demeaning to animals. Mm-hmm. I would be much more in favor of a much more humane way of treating animals if it actually happened. But the way we've moved to factory farming and it's really hard. I think the thing is, it's really hard to find meat that hasn't in some way experienced significant amounts of trauma. And when that trauma finds its way into the body, then then that trauma becomes a part of you. So a part of our idea of life is everything's interconnected and intertwined. Mm-hmm. We just don't want to be a part of
the system
that harms. We have this picture, two pictures on our wall as you walk through our immediate hallway from the front door to the living room. And it has a big picture with Mahatma Gandhi sewing his own clothes. And it says, nonviolence is the beginning of my creed and the end of my faith. Something like something akin to that. Mm-hmm. And then there's right next to that is a picture I got of Martin Luther King one of the civil rights museums in the South. And it has all these like quotes around nonviolence and peace and things like that. So when you walk into our home, like that's.
So nonviolence is really at like the core of who you are and who the family you and Shannon are creating. Yeah. And it happens that veganism is the manifestation of that.
It's at least one
of the nonviolent stance.
Yeah. It's not the only, but it's certainly one. I mean, it's one we come back to when we're talking about food, but when we're talking about other arenas, I mean, it's just, how do you think about compassion and nonviolence and peace in all that we do? And it's not to say that somehow we have magic answers around conflict in families or conflict when we disagree with each other about how to handle something, or when a kid doesn't want to go to bed, or I mean, it's just it then it becomes really challenging, but in a compassionate and clear way. And I hope that you will do the same. And that when you have a problem with me, you'll come and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have a problem in something you're doing that is not that is preventing me from getting what I need, then I will come to you and we will speak honestly. I mean, it's like that kind of creed.
Yeah.
And it's just hung right there. And sometimes I have to go back and read that when I don't handle things well. And sometimes I have to look at those pictures because that's what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
It really came as a result of being in seminary and discovering the nonviolent civil rights movement and discovering the peace movement. And it was right around the time of the Iraq War. And so we were very opposed to that war. And so, I mean, there's a lot of all of those things kind of came together. And veganism came later.
Okay.
So it's a huge part of our life.
Yeah.
It's an everyday part of our life.
Well, tell me about your spiritual and religious background and then where you locate yourself now.
Yes, yeah, so I grew up mainline Protestant, United Methodist. So there were two great-grandmothers of mine who were a huge influence in my life. Both are now dead. One of them died in 1997 and the other in 2009. So they were both like 96 and 101 when they died. And both had different ways of expressing faith but and what it meant to be a human being. But they both came from what I would consider to be the central theme of my life, which is love and peace. I met my great grandmother on my mom's side. I can still remember sitting on her front porch in Kentucky and her telling me that I was a child of God and that I was loved. From a very early age, that was set within me. My other grandmother was she did the same thing, but she did it less with words. I mean, she was just this compassionate, deeply compassionate person. She just like always showed up. She was always there. She sometimes would speak. When she would speak, it was just this font of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my paragons of what it means to be a person of faith. And we went to this small United Methodist church. Very early on there was a Sunday school teacher who said, "I'm going to give you this red pencil." And on it was the golden rule, written in gold lettering, but it was red.
What's the golden rule?
Love others as you would like to be loved. I mean, treat others be treated type of thing.
Okay.
And so she says, "I want you to take this home, but if you take away anything from any of my teaching, two things. One is every human being that you will ever come across in your life is a brother or a sister. God loves them. And you ought to love them as well. The other one was, there isn't anyone who's beyond God's redeeming love." I remember going and playing, we were playing football with neighborhood kids, and I turned to one of my friends, Robbie, "Hey, did you know that we're brothers and sisters in the Lord?" And he just like, "Dude, what? And it...
I'm sure Robbie was really well prepared to hear that.
Yeah, he was. He was totally. I mean, it made sense. The context totally made sense. We're playing tackle football. I mean, to me, it made logical sense. It made complete sense in my head and in my heart. I didn't really have any sense of faith all that much in high school until the very end. We went on a trip to do a habitat build. I think maybe it was a rekindling of my early childhood because I saw that same kind of compassion and love expressed to this family as we worked on the home together. And I went, wow, right, right. There's that part of myself, right. I almost shut it down entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like awoke within me. And so I spent that first year of college just taking classes but also going to church and finding my faith again, and then near the end of that discovered that I really think I'm called to ministry. So I went off to college. Well, my experience at Greenville College as well as Princeton Seminary, where I would follow up, all of that has shaped me. It has taken me out of a malaise of mainline Protestantism and evangelicalism that's very self self-absorbed. I'm not saying that both of them are all self-absorbed, just there are elements to both of those that have this self-absorption. And both going to Greenville and going to Princeton really just completely blew those things out of the water and opened me up to a completely whole nother theological, philosophical realm. So now I situate myself in the United Church of Christ. It's a denomination that believes deeply in the radical welcome of Jesus. Again, getting back to a little of the beginning, which is like, how do you raise children around those concepts? I mean, that's to teach our children what it means to welcome all people and to value all people, to see the dignity and worth and value of all people is a huge part of what it means to be United Church of Christ. And
it sounds like your religious practice has moved, but actually your theological roots have just grown deeper. Yeah. Like when you talk about those childhood concepts of original blessing and belovedness. Well, when you're seven and you hear that, that's all about you.
Yep.
But now you're, an adult pastor.
Yep.
Those roots are, well, it's about you and it's about your children and it's about your neighbor and it's about your enemy. And like, it's just gotten deeper.
Yep. Yep.
Sure, the place you go on Sunday mornings is different, but actually it doesn't sound like the theology. It just took you a while to find the right building.
It did. It circled around itself, and it to me it's about the whole. When I was very young, it was that perspective of I'm one part of the whole, and I am beloved, mm-hmm. and they are too, and I have to live my life that way. And my parents taught me that, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my church, to come back around to that in this time of the world is, I mean, it's a...
Well, let me jump to a question hard. That's really related to that.
Yeah.
So you're a white man, you're a religious leader.
Yep.
Could you talk about ways and spaces that you are holding your privilege and giving up your entitled space at the table to offer space for others? And how do you do that in a tangible way in light of what I know in you is some reflection about racism and institutional racism and the ways in which we are personally taught to think in racist manner?
Absolutely. To me, some of it is the recognition of privilege and the willingness to talk with and challenge others of privilege. On the one hand, just kind of general awareness of what my social location is in the world as a white straight male of able body, that has a lot that needs awareness. And I'm not sure that I'm positive I was not always aware of that. And most of us that are white skinned, for example, are not.
We don't have to be.
That's the privilege. We don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. We don't have to, unless we make it a part of our awareness. And so for me, having relationships with and working alongside of people who may not share the same location as I do is critically important for my own education of my space. Because sometimes I get called out. Other times it's a plain learning of like, oh my God, I didn't know that. So now I know. And then when I'm in other spaces with other white people or other heterosexual people or men for that matter, there's a context for me to be able to speak to the ways in which we're not entirely fully aware of those spaces and our power in those spaces. And I will say that's not always easy, but it's uncomfortable, and white people are very uncomfortable talking about their own race. And I actually think that we harm others by not. And so we have a lot of work to do. So I see myself as being a part of having that conversation in churches, in my family. Those are places where things come up all the time, actually, with our kids. So my kids are getting a vastly different experience being in an urban center.
Mm-hmm.
But it has fostered all those kinds of conversations mm-hmm. around what things that our daughter's friends, for example, have to experience that she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little bit of that going on in my professional life. I've been asking the question lately. I've been asking two important professional questions lately. When I'm making a decision or when I'm thinking about vision or I'm thinking about ways to shape projects, mm-hmm. I will ask the question, what haven't I thought of yet? And the other question is, whose voice is not at the table? And that second piece is really critical, I think, is like, because I think when we start essentializing things, then that our whiteness, our maleness, our sexuality, or whatever our location, when we essentialize everything to be that, then clearly we don't hear other voices that have a different perspective or come at it from a completely different experience. And so the question, that second question, is pretty important for me when I do all of those things, projects, make decisions on whose voice do I need to hear. So I will seek those voices out.
Right, because you can't actually answer the first question unless you have made sure that the second question is answered
well. That's right, absolutely. And so, when I need to think about something more deeply and how it will affect and impact things, those are the spaces I seek out are who are the friendships, the professional people in my life, the people who I know will tell it like it is to me rather than giving me what I think I need to hear or want to hear or mm-hmm. what most people in my social location are comfortable hearing. Mm-hmm. So I will say that those conversations aren't always easy. Sometimes they're hard.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say sometimes. Overwhelmingly, they're hard. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I'm a better person if I don't enter those spaces, if I don't listen, if I don't give up my voice and allow other voices to speak. It doesn't mean that my voice isn't relevant, but my voice is only my voice in relationship to the other voices around me.
Mm-hmm. How do you pray? What does prayer look like for you? And who is this God that you are praying with or to?
God permeates everything. God is, we are within God. I'm a panentheist, so I'm not a pantheist, but I live within this realm that we are within God. So there's not a part of this world where we can't go, where God doesn't reside.
Yeah.
So I've spent a lot of time praying in two different ways. One would be in complete silence. I think it's a radical shift for me, because I've always thought prayer was about more evangelical, like we have to have this personal relationship with Jesus and with God. And there's this sense that having a relationship means we talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's not true, because I do talk to God, but I think the mystic in me says God is everywhere. And so prayer is about being aware of that, coming awake to God's presence. So I consider prayer to be breath and breathing and silence. You know, the Quakers have a lot to teach us about just, and so for me, that's prayer. I mean, a lot of silence, a lot of breathing, a lot of contemplative centering prayer. And then other times it's intercessory. This morning I prayed for my friend Justo, who's having surgery this morning on his heart. You know, so it's about that too.
How does your prayer life dance with your parenting life?
The way that it works for me is when I've reached the point of I have no clue what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to my kid's problem. I don't know how to handle how they reacted to what I just said. I look at myself and I just say, well, I'm going to have to surrender that, because I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. What I have come to is I'm not always right. I have to ask for forgiveness. So my spiritual life includes saying to my children, man, I messed that up, kid. That wasn't what I had in mind, and that wasn't what I meant, or that wasn't a helpful way to handle how we just interacted. So,
yeah.
And I think that's something that my prayer life and spiritual life informs is I don't have all the answers. I don't even pretend to. For me, that's where prayer life intersects, is, okay, so God, help me out with that. Or I sit and meditate.
It's more of a mystery than I...
Parenting has taught me that prayer is mystery, because I don't have all the answers. I don't even come close.
Yeah.
So if I don't, sometimes my best answer to them is, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can figure it out together.
Yeah.
And that feels more authentic to me than well, this is just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what many of us hear.
You edited a book called Sacred Habits.
I did.
But one of the things you posit in the book is that there are four things that churches need to do to have robust, healthy community, which was deep listening, compassionate relationships, letting go, and opening to new ideas. Yep. And as soon as I read that, I thought, well, those feel like parenting tips to me. And so would you just speak to those, like the way that perhaps some of those four things, deep listening, compassionate relationships, letting go, and opening your mind to new ideas, like which of those do you find most helpful?
The two that really jump to me are the deep listening and compassionate relationships. I have a hard time with that around parenting. There's this inner conflict with that, because on the one hand, you want to be clear who's the parent, who's the child, mm-hmm. and what your role is and what their role is and what the boundaries are to actually develop a compassionate relationship. And deep listening to my children means I have to step away from that a little bit. I mean, not entirely, obviously.
From your
taking charge self, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm the parent self, and that part has to be there, because we have to set boundaries for what's safe and what's good, sure. and what's right for us. But then when you dive into the actual parenting piece of it, trying to be able to not just set boundaries or take charge, but to step back from that piece of myself for a minute to just listen to what they're going through.
Yeah. There's so much, it's messy, I guess, because on my very best days as a parent, I can like sift through the layers of like, this is not about the dishwasher. This is not about this, and get to
what it really is.
And now we are having, now I can listen to you compassionately.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for me, it's often like I am so escalated three doors in that we cannot get to the heart of what's going on until 3 days from now, because it's not like your child shows up and says, I would like to talk about a bullying situation that I witnessed at school today. That's providing a lot of anxiety for
me. That's right. Our life is just very, very busy and full. And so to your point, right, it's this sense of I don't have time really get to the heart of it. What I really needed to do was to take out the stuff out of the dishwasher and put the new stuff in the way I told you. I needed you to follow that the first time. And so part of it becomes, okay, so maybe I have to put the job aside for a little bit and the other things that I'm doing and simply sit and listen. And I think that that's really what they want, is this deep listening. The more my kids get to the teenage years as well, the more I realize that they're beginning the stage of differentiation. If they're beginning that process, it means that our relationship has gone from this intimacy in the early years to like this distance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good. I think all the family systems therapy stuff, all the family system stuff tells you that's good.
Yeah.
I which is fabulous. But I don't want to separate entirely to the point that if I have something to say to either of them, that they're not even willing to listen, because I haven't spent any time listening to what is of value to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the deep listening, the compassionate relationship piece for me is for me to sit and say, man, you had this bullying situation. Tell me about it. That sounds awful.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, well, I'm going to go down to the school and I'm going to talk to the principal. I mean, maybe that needs to happen.
But not then.
Right. And maybe, I think a lot of time for me, that's where there's this inner conflict between like the take charge parent that has to set the boundaries of what it means to be a part of the family, but also then stepping back from that and letting them actually be a part of the family,
mm-hmm.
letting them have voice.
Could you share a story of awe in parenting? Where have you felt just the overwhelming sense of awe or wonder?
I can remember there was one time, my daughter, I think she was in third grade, and they did this third grade wide musical. They had this, I can't remember the name of the musical now, but it was really cute. They had cats on one side, dogs on another. And the whole storyline was around cats can't be friends with dogs. Dogs can't be friends with cats. And these two dogs and cats defied that logic and became friends. And they really had to overcome a lot in order for them to be able to convince
the other groups
that there's dignity and there's worth in being in friendship. And the way they did it was just, it's funny, it's compelling. But I remember sitting in the auditorium almost in tears, just, that's it. The awe of parenting for me was in that moment. And this little play they did, I mean, accentuated that. And I immediately recognized that if I do anything as a parent, I hope it's that. I hope that's what they learn. Mm-hmm. I did have a sense of awe recently, too, around... We went to the Red River Gorge in Kentucky, and stunningly gorgeous. Huge mountains and all these trails, and it's amazing. So I was going to preach at Lexington Theological Seminary, and so we took the day before to just go and explore, because it's probably about a half an hour outside of Lexington. So we did this hiking, and of course, both of our kids are a little like hiking. I don't know. You know, that's not our thing. We get there and we go to what is called, it's called the Sky Bridge Hike. And essentially there's a spot where the rock forms this little bridge across to another part of the trail. And I mean, it's, and when you get to the
middle. It goes over the gorge.
Yes. And so when you look out, you see, I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
I remember us getting to that bridge, and it was like all the craziness of the trip there, and that we don't want to do this, complaints and whines just shut off. And it was, we were in creation, and it was, nature has a lot to teach us, and it made me aware that I need to do that more.
How has parenting shifted your spiritual life?
I think it's humbled me, and not, but it's made me realize my own limitations, my need to be vulnerable with them as well as with others. It's really shifted my faith life. And there was probably a point in time when I thought, this is what the faith is. This is what I believe. And I've come to believe that that's the height of spiritual arrogance. I don't think, I just don't know that that's true.
Yeah.
I think what I witness and experience in faith communities is our best attempt to understand, which is what I think the Bible is also, our best attempt to quite understand what is not even able to be understood. I mean, that, surprise, surprise, I'm a mystic. I just sitting in the middle of the unknown. So I for a long time, I was very uncomfortable with that. Mm-hmm. Like, no, it's got to be certain, or it's got to be clear, or it's got to be, in black and white ink or something, something that's, I can read and see and hear and taste and touch. And I've gotten to the point where I've just let go of that. And parenting's helped me along the way of that, of just saying, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure. And there would have been a time in my life where that would have made me wonder whether I had true faith.
Sure.
I definitely have opinions. I definitely have belief systems. I definitely have theology that guides. I definitely have a philosophy of life. I've shared some of that with you. But I hope that what my kids have taught me is, and what parenting has taught me about spiritual life is perhaps letting go of the need to know, or letting go of the need to control.
Mm-hmm.
Control is a pretty big spiritual issue.
Yeah.
And when I can control others, or think I can control spirit or God or myself or my kid or anyone else, then that's when I think I misstep, missing the mark, sin. I'd like to think that I've learned to just be patient and to listen and to wait.
Do you have a tidbit of wisdom to offer at the intersection of parenting and spirituality?
Find what really connects with your kid, mm-hmm. and find a way to nurture that. So for me, it's about going to the kid and saying, "What, you know, how do you want to do that? Mm-hmm. What's important to you? How mm-hmm. do you, maybe we draw, maybe we write a poem, maybe we, if you know your kid well enough, and you listen to them and you spend time with them, I mean, they'll tell you how they experience the world.
Yeah.
And for me, that's how you enter into spirituality. For me is, okay, let's, for our daughter, it would be drawing or dancing. That's, mm-hmm. you know, so she has done a couple of dances in worship services. And she's beautiful at pulling off the elegance and the grace with it mm-hmm. and connecting with the music. That's her gift.
It seems to me that there's a balance that, like, you know, my kids complain about church and right. all the time about going. And there's this balance for us of like, but you don't get to decide that yet.
Yeah.
Now, granted, my kids are younger than yours, but yeah. it's like that question of like, when do you get to decide? When do we decide to say mm-hmm. that like this congregational formation or this communal yeah. formation is sort of
yeah.
your, I yeah. think it's a question of like, how do you allow for their own agency
yeah.
bit by bit? If you start with your 3-year-old and you're like, what do you want to do? Well, I'm not even sure I want to take a 3-year-old to church,
yeah.
let alone do they want to go.
Yeah.
Could you speak to that a little bit?
I think that your comment about bit by bit makes a lot of sense to me, because we had a moment with our daughter where at our current church where we were like, we're going to make sure she goes to youth group, which is every other week. And she was complaining like, uh-huh. I'm not going to youth group. And she had this thing of like, well, but you can connect with kids your own age, you know, and get to know them. She's like, I have friends. I don't need other friends.
Mm-hmm.
And like, well,
and you don't live in that
we don't
town,
live in,
right? Okay.
No, we don't. And so I was like, yeah, but you can have friends from church and friends from school, right? And she said, I don't need friends from church. Why would I do that? And I'm like, okay. We made the decision that, you know what, we're a spiritual family. We're a family that goes to church,
mm-hmm.
and we're gonna do this. We're gonna give it a try. We need for you to give it a try.
The youth group,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been doing that, and actually, bit by bit, slowly by slowly, she's developed some relationships. I wouldn't mm-hmm. say it's aces and great and wonderful, but I would say she's giving it a try, and she's making the attempt to some degree, and that's a better step than where we were.
Do you think that works because you just decided that you have to do this? Like, did you listen and then sort of say,
we did,
here's a timeline? Or
we didn't give a timeline, but okay. we did listen, and then we just basically were like, okay,
you disagreed with her.
Yeah, it's back to agency, and we're good with giving her some space
mm-hmm.
to figure it out. We're not okay with her doing nothing.
I see. Yeah. And she's not 17.
No,
she's
right.
14.
That's right. And I think if I say to her, you have to do it this way, I want her to come to it authentically and in her own way of expressing
yeah.
it. And it may or may not look like mine. She may not grow up to be in the United Church of Christ.
Right. Her story will be
yeah.
long and her own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I hope she will look back. I hope they both will look back and say, those things that we did, those were meaningful. And I saw my father and my mother live out their faith with authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they can look back and see that. Because I can look back on my parents and see that. And I know my wife can look at her parents and see, given the circumstances that both of them were given, given who they were, how they grew up, and their social location in life, they lived it authentically.
Yeah.
It's not how I'm going to express it.
Yeah.
Because I don't express it the way they do, and neither does my wife of her parents. But we look at them and say, they paved a way.
Yeah.
Whether we're in the same stream or not.
Yeah.
So.
Chad, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you opening up
yeah.
and making time. And
yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.